I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. This week, NATO celebrated 75 years after catastrophes in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Sudan, Ukraine and Venezuela, to mention a few. At home, NATO countries today face mass opposition for their elite's role in arming genocide in Gaza, enabled by compliant NATO nation media. A wider war has already begun, with Britain and the USA aerially bombarding famine-hit Yemen. NATO nations armed the act of war on Iran as the Islamic Republic's diplomatic facilities in Syria were targeted in the past few days. Simultaneously, NATO countries pour billions to be defeated in a proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, and NATO members are strengthening military forces against China around an earthquake-hit Taiwan. Joining me from Chicago is Professor John Mersheimer, author and co-author of books including How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Thank you so much, Professor Mersheimer, for coming on. NATO at 75. I suppose we'd better just quickly start off with what you thought when you heard the news. The diplomatic buildings in Damascus had been destroyed, presumably with American weapons. An act of war certainly was not condemned by UN Security Council members, Britain, France and the United States.
Yeah, I was actually quite disappointed, but not surprised at all that Western countries didn't condemn the Israelis for attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus. If any other country had done that to any other country's embassy, the United States and its allies would have surely condemned that country. I mean, could you imagine if the Russians had hit an embassy in any country around the world? The United States and its allies would have gone ballistic. But with Israel, as always, it's a different story. The Israelis can do pretty much anything they want and get away with it.
And it just doesn't happen, does it? I mean, there was the Chinese embassy hit by mistake during the war in Yugoslavia. They're inviolable, the diplomatic facility in history, since Vienna conventions or...
Well, they're supposed to be, and there's good reason for that. And the fact that the Israelis violated that basic norm and basically get a free pass tells you something about Israel's ability to pretty much do anything it wants in international politics and get away with it because the United States will protect it.
And do you think it was an act by the Israeli government to draw the United States in, as has been talked about, as Iran clearly does not wish to be further involved? It certainly hasn't done what some feared, some wanted, as regards the genocide in Gaza.
Well, we don't have any real hard evidence to know exactly what the Israelis were thinking, but that would be my guess. The Israelis have long been interested in dragging us, the United States, into a war with Israel. A war with Iran. And I think that this was probably a step in that direction. Also, I think the Israelis are getting desperate at this point in time. The war in Gaza is not going well at all. One cannot see a happy ending to that conflict. They also have an ongoing conflict with Hezbollah on their northern border, which is not going well. And there doesn't appear to be any end to that one either. And then if you look at what's happening inside Israel itself, where there are all sorts of protests and disagreements of one sort or another, to put it more bluntly, there are a lot of centrifugal forces at play inside of Israel. And given all those factors, one could argue that the Israelis are just interested in escalating to see if they can get the United States involved, and that will help them solve some of these problems.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Gideon Levy of Haaretz on Monday's show. I mean, Israeli society, though, is not so much against the campaign against the people of Gaza. It's against Netanyahu per se. I mean, they agree with the campaign on Gaza and, if anything, want more firepower used on Gaza.
There's a remarkable survey that's out in Israel from a legitimate institution which shows that 68% of Israelis favor withholding humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza. This basically says that 68% of the population favors a genocide. This is quite remarkable. And it supports your point that within Israel itself, there's not wide differences of opinion among most people on how this war should be conducted. This is why the argument that if you get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu, all things are going to change and we're going to live happily ever after make no sense. It really doesn't matter whether you get rid of Netanyahu and replace him with Benny Gantz or Naftali Bennett. The end result will be the same. The Israelis will continue the same policies that they've been pursuing since October 7th. But this does not contradict the basic fact that inside of Israel, you have all sorts of centrifugal forces at play, and that the Israelis, in many cases, are at war with each other.
So when the United States abstained at the UN Security Council over the ceasefire resolution, was it a PR operation by Linda Thomas-Greenfield? Because they are centering attention on Netanyahu and ignoring what you just said about clearly popular support for the genocide within Israel. Why do you think they abstained just before announcing more weapons, of course, after Resolution 2728 was passed?
Well, the thing is that the Biden administration knows that it's in deep trouble in terms of the November election. There are large numbers of progressives, large numbers of young people, and the Arab American community in the United States that is deeply disturbed by what Biden is doing with regard to Gaza.
He's not that worried, is he? Because he announced all those weapons after that, as we know, the Michigan 100,000 at the primaries.
Well, what Biden wants here is he wants his cake and eat it too, right? He understands that he has to placate the Israel lobby and Israel's supporters in the United States. And at the same time, he wants to try to placate Arab Americans and progressives who might vote against him or just not vote for him in the fall. So he abstained from this binding resolution calling for a ceasefire during Ramadan. He abstained, which allowed it to go through. And then as soon as the resolution went through, Linda Thomas Greenfield said that it was non-binding. And of course, it is a binding resolution. Somebody could argue that it's non-binding is beyond me. But what was going on here is, again, Biden was trying to appeal to both sides. When he said it was non-binding, he was appealing to the Israeli side. By abstaining and letting the resolution go through the Security Council, he was appealing to progressives and to the Arab American community. And the question is, do you think that this is going to work? And my answer is no. In fact, there's a poll out that shows that in almost all of the critical swing states, he is trailing Trump by a rather significant number.
So who is advising the Biden administration, given that these tactics are clearly just going to alienate all sides, presumably, is what you think. I know Anatol Lieven, who's been on this show, has been talking about think tank groupthink. Is that what's going on in Washington? They all just think this is the policy, keep arming them, given the electoral constraints ahead of November.
Well, I think that virtually everyone who is advising Biden understands the problem here, and they would all love to fix it. But there is no fix. If he sides with the Israelis, clearly, then he's going to alienate progressives and Arab Americans and others, and this is going to cause him to lose in all likelihood in the fall. If, on the other hand, he sides with the progressives and with the Arab Americans against the Israelis, this will enrage the Israel lobby and Israel's supporters in the United States, and he's likely to lose in November. Because he alienated those institutions and individuals. So he's in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And there is no good solution for him.
Although a majority in polls show they don't support the war on Gaza as being as it's currently being conducted in the United States.
There's no question about that. You want to remember, by the way, that 75% of Democrats disapprove of what the Israelis are doing in Gaza, and they disapprove of America's support of Israel in this campaign. Furthermore, 50% of the people who voted for Joe Biden in 2020, this is 50%, believe that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. So Biden has a huge problem here because he is supporting the Israelis almost completely.
So the money is more important then from the donors? Because in the numbers terms, as you say, it's obvious the decision to take, if it was purely on electoral terms, don't support Israel.
Well, it's not only the money. I believe the money matters a lot. It's also the influence of the lobby in the media, in the mainstream media. If Biden were to turn against Israel in any meaningful way, you can rest assured that newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post would turn on Biden, and he would pay a significant price, which would badly damage his chances in the fall.
So the media is an enabler. You know, we had Professor Joseph Nye on this show the other week, the coiner of soft power, the term. He even said that soft power from the United States has globally been dented by the genocide. But then he said, look, there's a Pew poll out the other day. He was quoting it. Most people in 27 different countries would prefer the United States over China. So actually, genocide and supporting genocide doesn't harm the U.S.'s reputation around the world that much.
Well, I think that's wrong. I think that there's no question that our reputation has been badly damaged. And furthermore, I think that our emphasis on the importance of a rules-based order, the liberal international order, which matters so much to us, has been undermined by what the Israelis are doing and what we're doing with the Israelis. And I think that this is going to have long-term consequences.
You know, he also said, and he was chair of the U.S. Intelligence Council, he said on the other war, the other front of the United States' war, that no one really had confidence in the Minsk process in Ukraine when the European powers, the United States, were talking about the status of Ukrainian regions with Russia. Is Minsk being rewritten? And has it been rewritten since 2022? Have people forgotten about that to justify the sending of billions of dollars of weapons to Zelensky?
Well, the whole situation surrounding the Minsk agreement is really quite fascinating because it's quite clear to me that Putin was deeply committed to making Minsk work so that he could solve the controversy or the conflict in the Donbass. And of course, that's what Minsk was designed to do. And Putin did not want a war. He wanted to solve the problem in the Donbass diplomatically through Minsk. What has happened subsequently is that his interlocutors, Angela Merkel, for example, the French leader, Hollande, and Poroshenko, who was the Ukrainian leader at the time, all three of them, those were his three interlocutors, have admitted that they did not take the Minsk process seriously. And what they were doing was stalling for time so that the West could arm and train Ukraine. In other words, they bamboozled Putin. And Putin, who argued in good faith, is needless to say furious about what happened. Now, this story doesn't play very well in the West these days. So you can rest assured that in the West, the spinmeisters will go to great lengths to tell a different story, and they will try to blame Putin for what happened. And they will come up with all sorts of excuses for why Angela Merkel and the others are really not telling the truth, and it was really Putin who undermined the whole process. I mean, this is the way the game is played these days.
Professor Mersheimer, I'll stop you there. More after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, John Mersheimer. Professor Mersheimer, we were talking about the so-called Minsk agreements that preceded the beginning of the really hot war in 2022, proxy war in Ukraine. You know, the newspaper this week here says, NATO plans a $100 billion fund to shield Kiev aid from the winds of political change, and goes on to say, in case Donald Trump is elected. Do Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland's gone now, think of Russia as a kind of developing country, so it's a bit like Afghanistan war and this kind of war. They can keep pouring in the weapons and eventually Russia will just cave, or the region will become so unstable, the war will come to some kind of end that will benefit the United States. What is the strategy?
Well, I think that almost everybody in the West now understands that the Ukrainians are in deep trouble, and that the Russians, given the way events are moving, are likely to win this war. And what the Biden administration naturally wants to do is everything possible to prevent that from happening. So I think at this point in time, what the administration, the Biden administration, is focusing on, and what NATO is focusing on, is just stemming the tide, making sure that the Russians don't roll over the Ukrainians. And the question you have to ask yourself is, do you think that's possible? And my answer is no. I think this war is lost, and that the Russians will ultimately win an ugly victory.
And the longer it goes on, the terms of the peace will be worse for whatever government in Ukraine there is at that time.
Absolutely. I mean, from Ukraine's point of view, the best possible solution is to end the war now. Because the longer the war goes on, the more Ukrainians there will be more Ukrainians who die, and Ukraine will lose more territory. I believe it's in Ukraine's interest to try to shut the war down immediately and preserve as much of the territory that they now control as possible and minimize the number of Ukrainians killed moving forward. And to do that, what Ukraine has to do is turn itself into a genuinely neutral country. It has to make it very clear that it has no intention whatsoever of joining NATO, and it has to completely break off its security relationship with the West, especially with the United States. There can be no more arms transfers. There can be no more aid from the United States to Ukraine. That relationship has to be completely severed. And again, Ukraine has to become a neutral country. And the sooner this is done, the better. But of course, I think there is very little chance that Ukraine will do that, and the West will agree to push Ukraine down that road. And the end result will be that Ukraine will lose a lot more territory, a lot more Ukrainians will die, and Ukraine will end up as a dysfunctional rump state.
And when you say that, you're coming from the perspective of saving the children of Ukraine and also improving the strategic security interests of Western Europe and of the United States. So why don't they just do that?
I don't understand why they don't do that. I mean, a slightly different question is, why did we start this war to begin with? Why did we push NATO expansion into Ukraine when the Russians made it clear that they viewed it as an existential threat? And if we didn't stop, it would lead to war. That was manifestly clear for years. And nevertheless, at every turn, we doubled down. And in late 2021, early 2022, when it looked like a war was about to happen, and the Russians actually made an attempt to solve it diplomatically in December of 2021, we basically told them we weren't interested, and we allowed the war to happen. And then after the war broke out and there were negotiations in Istanbul, and it looked like there was a serious possibility the war could be shut down, we basically told the Ukrainians to walk away from the negotiations and to pursue war. This is remarkably foolish. The end result is that Ukraine is going to be destroyed. So I think the fact that we're not moving now to push Ukraine to become neutral is hardly surprising, given how foolishly we have behaved in the past. We, of course, meaning the West here, and that includes the United States.
You say you don't know, but then in whose interests? I mean, is it the military-industrial complex? Because even that analysis that you just gave me, as you know, is more or less banned in the media of NATO nations that are pouring the weapons in the free media of NATO nations. I mean, obviously, we know Lloyd Austin worked at Raytheon and that Antony Blinken is a West exec. Is it really that base, that it's military contracts? I mean, they're very open about the importance of military Keynesianism as a strategy regarding Ukraine to improve jobs at home. Is it about money that way?
I think it's a somewhat complicated story. I think that for many years, up until 2014 for sure, maybe even up until the war broke out in February of 2022, we thought that we could shove NATO expansion into Ukraine down the Russians' throat. You want to remember that we had two big tranches of NATO expansion before the whole Ukraine fiasco. One was in 1999. That's when Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic came in. And then we had another big expansion in 2004. That's when the Baltic states, Romania, Bulgaria, and a handful of other states came in. And in all those cases, the Russians were deeply opposed and made their opposition very clear to the West that NATO expansion was unacceptable to them. But nevertheless, they were weak, and we forced it down their throat. And I think we felt that we could do the same thing with Ukraine. Okay, the Russians don't like NATO expansion into Ukraine, but what are they going to do about it? Then when it looked like a war was going to break out, I think we came to the conclusion that we could beat the Russians. I think this is why we told the Ukrainians to walk away from the negotiating table in Istanbul in March, April of 2022, right after the war started. We thought we could beat the Russians. We had a theory of victory. Of course, that theory of victory was fundamentally flawed, and things have not turned out the way that we believed that they would turn out.
And now we have people openly talking about the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, we had a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Larry Korb, from the Reagan administration saying, of course, if necessary, the United States would use nuclear weapons based in Ramstein Air Base in Germany to save the people of Ukraine. How far is the United States just talking about the importance of Ukraine now it's got to this stage? Have they privately, as far as you know, just realized that it hasn't worked out the way you just said they hoped it would?
Well, they certainly realize it hasn't worked out. And I think almost everybody at this point in time understands that Ukraine could collapse and end up as a dysfunctional rump state, and the Russians could end up controlling.
Sorry to interrupt, Professor, but, you know, at the NATO celebrations of 75 years, all those leaders are not saying anything like that, obviously.
No, they'll be celebrating. Look, if the Russians win, even if it's an ugly victory, this is going to be a devastating defeat for NATO. And the leaders in Washington who are celebrating the 75th anniversary of NATO are going to want to go to great lengths to downplay what's happening in Ukraine and celebrate the alliance and talk about its wonderful future. So you won't be hearing much discussion of just how desperate things are in Ukraine. The fact is the situation is developing in ways that are going to be disastrous for NATO.
You see, if you look at Russian media and Global South media, there's talk of doubling down by NATO countries. The Crocus Hall massacre in Moscow, the ties to... you might want to explain what ISIS-K is, because I think most people around the world see it as a catalyzed by US policy in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. People are saying they're doubling down on it, and France has plans, according to the Russians, of sending more than 1,000, maybe 1,500 foreign legion NATO country member soldiers to help Zelensky, in which Putin has said that he will react to that militarily.
I don't believe the French are going to send troops into Ukraine. I believe the Americans will tell them in no uncertain terms that that is not possible. And the Germans will do the same. And I think there'll be significant resistance within France itself if Macron tries to do that. You were talking before about the possibility of the West using nuclear weapons to defend Ukraine should the Russians win. I think that's extremely unlikely. I think that the United States is not going to initiate nuclear use. I don't even think we're going to think seriously about that possibility. And again, I don't think we're going to send in troops either. I think that we will just have to accept the fact that we lost in Ukraine. And then what we will do, foolishly, I believe, is everything possible to undermine Russia's position in those parts of Ukraine that it ends up annexing, and more generally doing everything we can to cause trouble for Russia moving forward. So even if we get a frozen conflict, I think what's likely to happen here is that you're likely to have an intense security competition between Ukraine and the West on one side and Russia on the other side for the foreseeable future. And the potential for escalation in this competition, this nasty competition, will be significant.
What's it like being a scholar in international affairs right now? I know in the media, I mean, in Britain, it's illegal, de facto, to mention that there are any Nazis or neo-Nazi-linked groups in Ukraine. Israel has just banned Al Jazeera. RT is banned, and CGTN, the Chinese and Iranian TV stations in Britain. Academics and scholars who talk like you, you just don't see on the media or in the big think tanks. I've interviewed many who say, no, Ukraine still has a chance. It can get Crimea back. What's it like being a scholar these days?
If you have my views, it's going to be a rough road to hoe in the mainstream media. And in fact, you're going to be basically iced out. They're not going to be interested in hearing your views. There will be, you know, occasions where you slip through the iron wall and you get to make your case, but those occasions will be few and far between. What we have in the West is a particular mantra about the Ukraine conflict that is dominant. It dominates the discourse, and anybody who challenges that dominant view is going to be attacked and is going to be frozen out.
Is that one of the reasons for the failure of NATO, not hearing all the sides?
I believe that. I believe the fact that we in the West have in effect shut down the marketplace of ideas when it comes to talking about Ukraine has led to all sorts of trouble. I think if we had a more open debate about Ukraine and the idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO after 2014, that we might have been able to head this problem off. But after 2014, when the crisis broke out, that was February 2014, it became very difficult for people with my view to be heard. And on those occasions, when they were heard, they were basically smeared as Putin's puppets or apologists for Russian behavior or what have you.
Professor John Mearsheimer, thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US EU armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria and Iraq. We'll be back on Monday with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.